Our next presenter is Chris Holden. Chris Holden is the assistant music librarian at the Music Library at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. He was responsible for cataloging the music library's materials in all formats and also acts as the liaison to the School of Theater and Dance. He is a current member of the Music Library Association, the Music OCLC Users Group, and the Online Audiovisual Catalogers. Prior to his current position, Chris earned his MSLS at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill in 2013, where he wrote his master's paper on the application of the Ferber model to popular music. That's functional requirements for bibliographic records. He also holds an MA in Interdisciplinary Humanities from Florida State University and a BA from Kenyon College, where he double majored in music and philosophy.
Good morning, and thank you all for attending. I'm going to be talking about the application of Ferber to playback musical works. And if you don't know what Ferber is, that's okay. I'm going to be providing a brief overview of the model before delving into how it applies to music, and specifically music as conceived of as recorded sound. So, to start off, what is Ferber? As Sandy mentioned, Ferber stands for the Functional Requirements for Bibliographic Records. Well, what is that? What Ferber is supposed to be is a model of how to organize information that will allow patrons to sort of wade through the wealth of data we have out there and find exactly what we're looking for, what they're looking for. It's an entity relationship model, which means that it's built in such a way that it maps relationships between different works and their creators and other people involved in the expression and materialization of works. The new cataloging guidelines, RDA, that were adopted by many libraries last year are based on the Ferber model. And what Ferber does is it creates this four-tier hierarchy of entities: the work, the expression, the manifestation, and the item. And you can see a chart right here. From top to bottom, you have work at the top is sort of the most abstract, down to item at the bottom. Because it's a hierarchy, each one is contained in the one that comes above it. So one work can be realized through multiple expressions, one expression can be embodied in multiple manifestations, and one manifestation can be exemplified in multiple items. So what does all this mean? Well, it's supposed to be a map that allows you to sort of chart how a single creative work can find itself expressed in a multitude of different formats. So if you take, for example, Shakespeare's Hamlet, Hamlet itself is a work. It's just sort of an idea. There's not one golden tablet somewhere with Hamlet etched into it that you can point to and say that represents Hamlet. But rather, it's sort of an abstract idea that can be expressed through printing an English language text. It can be expressed through translating it into Spanish. It can be expressed through putting it on in a play. It can be expressed through making a movie of Shakespeare's text. And all of these are different expressions of that work. And if you take one of those expressions, such as an English language text, then it can be printed in a hardback book, it can be printed in a paperback book, and all of these would be different manifestations. It's a material thing. And finally, if you have the work Hamlet, which is expressed through English language and printed as a manifestation in a hardback book, then if I buy one single copy of that, that would be an item, one single thing I can hold in my hand. So we can talk about how this applies specifically to music, and I'm going to use Beethoven here as an example. Beethoven is the creator, and he comes up with the idea for a work. Keep in mind that the work is abstract at this point. It's not any material thing, but it's an idea that exists in Beethoven's head. And this work, in this case the Fifth Symphony, can be expressed maybe through a written score or maybe through a performance. Both are valid expressions of the work, and you can't point to one and above the other and say, no, that's the work, but not that. Both are different ways of expressing this idea. And now if we go further, the score can be manifested, say, Baron Reiter can print an Urtext edition. That would be a manifestation. The recording can be manifested on an LP release or a CD release. And finally, if I buy one of those LPs as one specific item, then that would be the lowest level. So to recap, you have the work, Beethoven's idea. It finds expression through an audio recording, which is released as an LP, as a manifestation. And finally, one specific copy of that LP would be the item. So you can see here that we're going from abstract on the upper left all the way to concrete on the bottom right. Work is very abstract to the point where you can't really point and say what it is, and an item is a very specific thing you can hold in your hand. And I drew this dividing line down the middle so you can see work and expression sort of represent what's known as ideational content or intellectual ideas, and the manifestation and item represent how these ideas are translated into actual, I guess, text or notes or sounds or what's known as semantic content. Work and expression are the idea, and they're sort of delivered through content, through the manifestation and the item. Well, so what? Ferber assumes that all creative activity begins as this idea and then becomes materialized in semantic form. So a composer such as Beethoven comes up with an idea of the work, and then it's materialized in a lot of different ways through different ways of delivering content, whether through a score or through a recording or something like that. Beethoven takes his idea and finds the appropriate tools to materialize this idea. And this makes sense for classical music, as I think I've shown with Beethoven. There's no one singular manifestation of his Fifth Symphony that you can point to and say, aha, that is the Fifth Symphony. Rather, it exists in sort of this multitude of different manifestations. There's no one recording that represents the Fifth Symphony better than another, but rather all of these together are different manifestations of the work as an abstract idea, and this works because classical music is something that is first composed and then performed. So you have this separation between the idea and then how the content is manifested. But what about recorded music? And this is why I'm delivering this presentation here at this organization. I think that a lot of recordings of music are conceived of in a fundamentally different way than maybe Beethoven's Fifth Symphony and how I just talked about that. A lot of recordings don't necessarily represent live performances, and some recordings that might not even be possible to recreate live at all. Through the magic of studio technology, you can put a lot of things on a recording, and many of these sounds couldn't be recreated live. It's something that can only exist on a recording. And because of this, I think the separation of the idea and the content is much more difficult to delineate with certain recordings. So, for example, I'm going to talk about here, Steve Reich is this 20th century avant-garde composer, and he came up with this work called It's Gonna Rain, and it's an early example of audio sampling. What he did is he took a recording of a street preacher delivering this apocalyptic rant, and he took one soundbite from this sermon where the preacher says, it's gonna rain, and Steve Reich took it and looped it over on itself and started splicing together different versions of this soundbite over and over and over. And it goes on for something like 17 minutes, but here I can play you just a brief 10-second clip. Well, here's the thunderstorm. Pretty good stuff, huh? just what you wanted to hear on a Saturday morning. But why I'm bringing up like this piece specifically is I think it's different from Beethoven in that we're not starting with an idea and then finding ways to express this idea. Instead, Steve Reich is starting with a very specific set of sounds. He's already starting with the actual semantic content, and then he's manipulating it. Rather than coming up with an idea and finding a way to express it, he's sitting down with actual stuff and rearranging it. So how would this work in the Ferber model? In the Ferber model, Steve Reich would come up with this idea for his work, It's Gonna Rain, and then he would decide to express it through an audio recording. And this audio recording could be released on a CD, and maybe I would have one copy of this CD as an item. And so Ferber still sort of works for something like this that's fundamentally conceived of as an audio recording. But because Ferber assumes the work is an abstract idea, there would also be different ways to express this work. For example, if someone were to take what you just listened to and actually notate it and write it out as a score, under Ferber, this would also be an expression of the work. And it would just be just as authentic, I think, as listening to the actual sounds. So we have to ask ourselves, when we're talking about a musical work, are we talking about an abstract idea of chord sequences, notes, rhythms, and lyrics? If so, I think that the Ferber model handles this well. With Beethoven, again, there's no one singular thing you can point to and say, that's Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, but rather it's an abstract idea, and anyone who either writes down that specific set of notes or plays that specific set of notes is performing a valid expression of the work. But if we think the musical work includes things like timbre, manipulation of recorded material, specific decisions made regarding sound mixing or sound mastering, then I think the Ferber model falls short. After all, Steve Reich isn't just coming up with an idea of someone saying it's gonna rain over and over and over, but he's actually sitting down with actual sounds he wants you to hear. He's not just making decisions on what notes should be performed, but how the actual sound will reach the listener. So we can use a second example here, Pink Floyd's famous album, Dark Side of the Moon. This was primarily known through its release in 1973 as recorded audio, but remember, under Ferber, there might be multiple expressions of this work. So how would Dark Side of the Moon work in the Ferber model? And at this point, you might be able to play along. The band Pink Floyd comes up with an idea for the work, Dark Side of the Moon. This work finds expression through recorded sound. This expression can be manifested through the LP that was released in 1973, but also the remastered LP released in 1979, the CD released in 1984, and the SA CD released in 2003. But if we take a step back, remember that there could be more than one expression for a work. Pink Floyd also played Dark Side of the Moon live in concert in 1974, and this found its way onto the 2009 box set, which included different live performances of this same work. And then we could even take a broader perspective and remember that Pink Floyd is not the only performer to put on Dark Side of the Moon. There have been other groups that have covered the entire album. The Flaming Lips came out with a 2009 album that covered the entire thing. There was a tribute album called Return to the Dark Side of the Moon that was released in 2006. There was even a reggae version called Dub Side of the Moon that came out a few years ago. And someone remixed that and called it Dubber Side of the Moon. And eventually you get this huge, I made sort of a partial Ferberized chart of all the different expressions and manifestations you can get of Dark Side of the Moon. On the left-hand side here, we have every different recording or performance of the work, and all of these are different expressions. And on the right-hand side, every time one of these recordings is released in a different format, whether that be CD or LP or cassette or MP3, it would be a different manifestation. So is this viable as a way to look at Dark Side of the Moon? On the one hand, I think Ferber does a very good job at mapping how all these things relate to one another. We have all these different manifestations, and they can all be mapped back to this one abstract work. But as a librarian, I need to ask, is this giving patrons what they want? If a patron comes into the library and asks for Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, I think it's a very valid question to ask in response, are you looking for a score or are you looking for a recording? If you're looking for a score, are you looking for a study score or a conductor score? Or if you're looking for a recording, which conductor are you looking for? Which performance are you looking for? Because there's no one Beethoven's Fifth Symphony that you can pull off the shelf. But if someone comes to a library and asks for, do you have Dark Side of the Moon, I'm not going to respond by saying, well, which expression of Dark Side of the Moon are you looking for? I'm going to assume that they're asking for this 1973 recording. Whether it's on LP or CD might be a different matter, but it's the same set of sounds either way. Ferber assumes that the 1973 performance would be one performance among many, but I think for most people looking for this, this would be the work, not just a performance of the work. So the philosopher Stephen Davies makes this distinction between thick and thin works that I think is interesting to bring up. A thin work is something that has relatively few determinative sonic properties, meaning a lot of decisions are left up to the performer. So for example, if you take a folk song like She'll Be Coming Round the Mountain, that would be considered a thin work because you can perform it in many different ways. Maybe you can just sing it as a folk song, maybe you can play it with a banjo. Neil Young got together with Crazy Horse and performed a version with his rock band. So all of these are different expressions of She'll Be Coming Around the Mountain, and there's no one that you can elevate above the other. Because it's a folk song, it's thin in such a way that performers can bring a lot to the table. Thick works, on the other hand, a lot of the properties and sonic details are crucial to the performance of the work. And thick works can have only one authentic instance. So, for example, with Steve Reich and It's Gonna Rain, it's a thick work in that he put together one specific set of sounds, and I think if you're not hearing those sounds that Steve Reich himself picked out, then you're not really listening to the work. In the Ferber model, all works are thin works. They're these abstract ideas that are then manifested through the decisions of a performer. But thick works, on the other hand, sort of conflate the role of composer and performer. Is Steve Reich a composer or a performer when it comes to It's Gonna Rain? Is Pink Floyd a composer or a performer when it comes to Dark Side of the Moon? These roles begin to get mixed up a little bit, and it's hard to make that call. So I'm going to bring up here, this is one song from Dark Side of the Moon, is Pink Floyd's Money. And this is sheet music that anyone could sit down and play the song from it. And according to Ferber, this would be an expression of the work, and it would be, I guess, considered a thin work here in that it's just a set of notes that anyone could play and performers can sort of bring their different interpretations to the table. But is this, I guess, a valid expression of the work Money? I don't know, a lot of you have probably listened to it, but money isn't just a set of notes that people play. Money is a specific set of sounds that the band picked out. And I'll play you an example here. So if we're going to assume that money is a thin work, then anyone playing from the sheet music would be able to create a valid instance of it. But if money is a thick work, then you have to listen to those specific cash register sounds that the band picked out and spliced together and created the sound collage that shifts into that weird 7/4 beat that you hear. So Dark Side of the Moon could be a thin work in this just assemblage of chords and melodies and lyrics, or it could be a thick work in terms of, well, you're not really listening to it unless you're listening to the specific sounds that the band themselves picked out. So I'll end here with a thought experiment from another philosopher, Theodore Grassik. And he came up with this idea, what if, say, Bruce Springsteen's 1975 album, Born to Run, what if every copy of it disappeared? Say, aliens flew in one day, and they abducted everybody's copy and disappeared, and now it's gone. Would we still have access to the work, Born to Run? Well, we'd still have access to Bruce Springsteen's live performances of these tracks. We'd still have notated scores of the music. We'd still have cover versions by other artists. But Grassik argues that because we're missing the specific sounds that were put on the master tape by Bruce Springsteen and his producers in 1975, we no longer have access to the work. In this case, Born to Run would be a thick work. If you're not listening to those specific sounds that Bruce Springsteen picked out, then you're not listening to the work, regardless if you're listening to someone else performing the same notes. So a lot of this is sort of, well, how many angels can sit on the head of a pin? Why does this matter at all? Well, there's several developments in the cataloging world right now that are pushing towards a linked data model in the future. There was a great presentation yesterday about linked data as applies to jazz music. And what it is cataloging is moving towards ways to map and link all these different entities together and find a way to, I guess, create a roadmap of how composers and performers relate to works and their expressions and manifestations. And this requires us to make very specific decisions about how to model these relationships between works and their creators. So yes, this is sort of an abstract and overly philosophical problem, but I think it's also an actual very real data modeling problem. How are we going to map these works going forward? I think Ferber works well for mapping relationships between classical music and their manifestations, but for these playback works, works that are meant to be, I guess, heard as a recording and not necessarily as a performance, I wonder if Ferber is the best way to model these relationships. It places emphasis on musical works as abstract entities when a lot of these are not abstract, but actually a very concrete set of sounds that was assembled on tape. So I'll leave you with this quote from Brian Eno, the famous producer and composer, that I think is a good summary of what I'm talking about. He says, in studio composition is where you no longer come to the studio with a conception of the finished piece. Instead, you come with actually rather with a bare skeleton of the piece, or perhaps with nothing at all. I often start working with no starting point, actually constructing a piece in the studio. And so I think this is a good example of how this sort of method of composition differs from Beethoven and this idea of work as something abstract. Someone like Brian Eno is starting with something very concrete and material. Thank you all for listening. This is my first ARSC conference, and I've been very impressed with everything thus far. So thanks for your time.
We actually have 5 minutes for questions for any of our presenters. Questions?
Hello there. I have 2 points, but the first is that the Beethoven example you gave for Symphony No. 5, simplified this, but there is actually a host of other expressions that go into the expression and manifestation of like Beethoven Symphony No. 5, because the performers are actually performing a specific edition of that. That work.
Yeah, you can have expressions of expressions and things. There can be a lot more layers.
And that's where it gets complicated, and that's where mapping it in Mark and our rules really doesn't do the cataloger any favors right now, and really doesn't do our patrons any favors in terms of the interfaces that we can currently serve this to. And also, my second point was about the Steve Reich example, and it's really analogous actually to books and other materials which were made for Ferber and RDA in that. We don't see a lot of the pre-production material that goes into a book. I mean, a book may have written notes made in the construction and oral history interviews that were taken in, but we only see the construction of it, while it's much more apparent when we get to a recorded work, like as you've shown, for its little bits to hang out and for us to be confused by as catalogers.
I apologize, this is kind of a novice question, but can you give us some examples how linked data applies to this?
Well, linked data would be, did you attend the talk yesterday on the jazz linked data? So you'd have, if you say Beethoven wrote the work, the Fifth Symphony, then you'd create sort of a triple in RDF where you'd have one entity represented by Beethoven, one entity that represents the work, the Fifth Symphony, and then you could put in a third line that says that is a verb that means Beethoven composed this work. But then there might be other verbs coming from Beethoven saying he also composed this work. And what you're doing is linking Beethoven as the composer to this work, and then you're linking this work to any CDs that might have been released of this work. And so I'm showing you here sort of how four different entities are linked, but really there might be hundreds or thousands of different entities that can all be mapped back to this one work. And I guess the point is trying to be so that you can't just, like right now if you go on Amazon, if you search for Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, maybe a lot of different CD releases come up, but the idea is that you can click on, I want to look at the work, the Fifth Symphony, and then you'll get a whole list of different manifestations of that work, if that makes sense. Or you could click on Beethoven, see all the different works that he composed and all of their expressions.
I've got a question for Danielle about her presentation. Two questions, and they're not related in any way. The first one is with the Indonesian recordings. Has there been much interest in Indonesian institutions or Indonesian performers in the archive that you've got? I noticed that you said that the copyright belonged to the field worker. But I wonder whether any of the Indonesians have a different view on that. But before you answer that one, the other unrelated question is in relation to the shared shelf software package that you've been using. At some of the earlier sessions in this conference, we got advice, record collectors, got advice from archivists and librarians, don't catalogue your collection. It's of no use to us. A rough inventory might be of interest, but many of us who have collections are very interested in cataloguing them, describing them, retrieving items. And I just wonder where in the hierarchy of open source catalog software this shared shelf sits.
Okay, so I'll answer the second question first just because it's fresh in my mind. First, I don't know exactly who's advising you not to catalog your content, and I'm not saying, obviously anytime you catalog something, you're going to have your own standard and maybe it'll be useful or not. But in my experience, whenever I get a collection in to the library, I'm really thankful for whatever data comes with it. So I don't think you should be dissuaded from doing extensive work on it. I find it really useful to have whatever information we can about the contents within a collection. So Shared Shelf is actually part of ArtStore's package of cataloging tools. And it isn't open source right now. It's actually a subscriber model. But I don't know, at some point they may actually open it up. It is a really useful tool. We use it for all of our collections that we're developing with faculty right now. And it can handle a wide range of formats, and you could do a lot of bulk editing. That said, I know there are tools out there for that type of thing that are open source and are free. I'm trying to think of some right off the top of my head. Let me think about it, but I can probably meet you afterwards. In terms of the copyright, you raise a really good point about the Indonesian field recordings, and it is always tricky. You're correct that the players themselves would likely lay claim to these recordings as well. Marty was the actual recorder and engineer, if you will, of all of these sessions. We try to be open-minded and when we launch collections like this to allow for as much latitude as possible. It is a teaching and learning collection, so in some ways we can argue fair use. But if, say, the folks in Indonesia, with whom Marty is still in touch, so it's not like he doesn't still maintain a connection to the folks over there. Part of it is actually to open this material and give it back to them. Often, when you avail something like this online, you can, in fact, you know, they don't have access to it either. And so we hope that actually they will be pleased by having this available. But certainly, if none of this is commercially available, so none of this content could be generating revenue, so we, you know, we're careful, but we try and be liberal in our policies. And if somebody were to come to us and say, absolutely, we want you to take it down, we take it down. So I don't know if that answers your question.
That's actually all we have time for. You're welcome to come speak to the presenters after. And let's go ahead and thank our presenters.